One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
Iconic, that's the best adjective to describe the track by John Lennon there, Imagine. And iconic is something you can use to apply, obviously, to Graham Harper. It is, of course, your show, Graham, once again. Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision, Volume 3. We are scooting through them. How are you?
Good afternoon. Very well, thank you.
Good. Very good. So, you kind of wrapped up the last sequence on the traditional Doctor Who cliffhanger with, obviously, the backstory behind your choice of the Beatles and A Day in the Life and the final regeneration sequence for Peter Davidson's Doctor into Colin Baker, of course.
Yes, it was. It really, really helped me to create the vision that I wanted to get or try and get. In fact, I never quite got what I wanted because we ran out of time and money. So what you see is what you get, really. But it had a huge influence on me, as I think it did many, many people throughout the world. That album, Sergeant Pepper, and that particular track, that little bit right at the end, was really extraordinary. I'd never heard anything like that. I don't think anybody had in a rock and roll record. It was a stunning piece of amalgamation with George. I've forgotten his surname now.
Martin,
who really helped the Beatles to create all their fantastic sounds and background sounds and whatever, as well as arranging all the music, I think. So quite brilliant. That kind of leads me on to Imagine, which is another John Lennon song. Gosh, that song really hit everybody again. I can't think of anybody, I don't know personally, who Imagine that song didn't really affect. It was so iconic, and it's a beautiful piece of music. It's a beautiful song about peace, and we need to this day peace in this world. From 1969, I joined the BBC. Well, I'd already been the BBC, but I joined the drama department of the BBC from 1969 and worked my way up through the ranks till 1982, when I became a director, having done the director's course at the BBC. And the reason I'm telling you all that is because I worked on a variety of programmes as a young assistant director, like Doctor Who's. I did several Doctor Who's throughout that time, working with other directors, obviously. The Master of Ballantrae, War and Peace by John Davis, who he directed it. Great director. The first time I really felt I was in the midst of a god. He's a terrific director. And I'm saying all of this because of the music. There was War and Peace, Ivanhoe I worked on with David Maloney. He also did many Doctor Who's. Nightmare Man with Douglas Camfield. Fabulous, unusual director, who eventually became a really close personal friend. But I really enjoyed working with him as a director. They had a big effect on me, these people. Bergerac, the first series, there was an episode directed by Martin Campbell, who went on to do James Bond, Zorro, etc. It was a terrific shock to the system when you work with him. He was a cameraman who worked at ITV, and then made it into the directing world. So he had the fantastic skill of really understanding and knowing cameras and the lenses and shots that you could get. And he had an extraordinary vision as a director. And when I worked with him, I discovered someone who really knew how to use the camera and enjoy making something that really tantalized you as the viewer, challenged you, gave you fantastic vision. So in that Bergerac, you will see a terrific director at work. I don't think he'd done very much as a director by that time, but he'd obviously, I think he worked on Crossroads, a variety of shows for ITV. But he, when you worked with him, you knew that this man was going to go on to do great things. Edge of Darkness then came next. Wow, when that hit the screen and the way it was shot, like Imagine, that changed the whole world in television. Of the what was expected of you as a director producing material. He was the benchmark. He was a high benchmark for everybody. And there have been many directors since who have really achieved great things, but I think it started with him. And then Testament of Youth with Moira Armstrong. What a fantastic director with such heart and soul. I think they all had, but she had such a soul, and she searched and reached the depths of the possibilities with actors of what they could achieve and what they could bring out. But she did it in a beautiful way. She was a real collaborator. I learned about collaboration through these people. They were wonderful directors, but their use of music was astounding. And I tried to do my best with what little time I had around my own job working with other directors, to go to all the edits, some stage of all these people, to understand and learn how they put their shows together and how the shots all came together. And then finally, in the dub, the use of all the effects, obviously, but music. And I began to realise how important and powerful music can be to any production if it's used correctly. When Imagine came out, we all knew everybody. I was an assistant director at that stage. It was 1971. I was a junior. But we all knew that piece of music was going to be used by somebody badly somewhere, really misused. It's such an important piece of music. And to my knowledge, it never was until The Killing Fields, this marvellous, horrific film, but marvellous production, which was about Sidney Schoenberg and Dith Pran. He was a photographer, I think, in Cambodia, who helped Sidney Schoenberg, who was working for the New York Times, I think, covering the Cambodian War. And at one stage, they get into real trouble, and Sidney manages to get out of Cambodia just in time before the barriers go down and they're all trapped, and Dith Pran's left there. And then this film unfolds this horrific story of how the middle classes are culled by the Khmer Rouge, etc. And Sidney loses touch with his very close friend, and for several years struggles to find out what's happened to him. And eventually, right at the end of this film, I'm going to have tears because it's a very moving moment. There's a moment where Sidney Schoenberg discovers that Dith Pran is in a refugee camp somewhere, and manages to get back to the Asia, and because I can't remember which country he was in, but he managed to get to find Dith Pran, and there's a moment where the two of them meet right at the end of the film, and on the radio, I think it's in a car, you hear a tinny version of Imagine, and then gradually as the two men realise that they've found each other, they don't run, but they almost do a romantic run to each other, and of course Imagine then takes over. It is the most moving moment, I think, of any movie I think I can remember. It was just the perfect use of Imagine and how important music can be to a film or to a scene.
And of course, Heinges Ingor, who played Dith Pran, I think sadly passed away a few years ago. But that was at a time, of course, Goldcrest, I think, responsible for The Killing Fields. And there did seem to be a moment in the 80s where certainly British film as such was really sort of beginning to evolve onto the world stage until, of course, Revolution came about and Colin Welland said, I think, these immortal words which came back to haunt him, "The British are coming," at an Academy Awards ceremony. And then it all went pear-shaped for a while, really, but still, never mind.
Bless him.
I mean, you mentioned a number of directors there that had influenced you in terms of your working with them and the collaborative process. And who knows if they're still going, you might like to invite them onto your programme in the near future and actually sort of have a chat with their sort of thoughts on aspects of it. But did you feel at the time that actually you were like a sponge soaking up everything? Was it a case of you had a clear vision, having obviously, as we've seen in previous programmes, been very much influenced by David Lean and company? Was this something that you kind of think, or was just a case of, look, you really wanted to actually learn everything you could about the art and the craft of filmmaking?
I wasn't, not when I first started in drama. I was just in awe of everybody. Oh, well, I've kind of made it because I'm in the drama department at the BBC. And if you remember in that period, there was only BBC One, I suppose. It wasn't called anything. It was BBC Television. ITV, of which there were several companies that fed into ITV, like Yorkshire Television and Granada, et cetera, et cetera. And then during my start at the BBC, BBC Two started and colour came in. In fact, I remember being a junior runner and going and sitting in to do tests of colour for different departments, etc. So that was an exciting period. When I started in drama, I never really thought about, oh, and I'm going to watch now very carefully how directors work. I was so in awe of it all, and I had to find my way and find my place within the company. And also, was it the right place for me to be? Was I really a valuable commodity to the BBC or to anybody? And gradually, I did seem to fit in because I managed to get confirmed as a proper member of staff as an assistant floor manager, which in drama meant like a second assistant director and an art director moulded together. It was only, I suppose, towards when I started to get my first jobs as a first assistant, that's when you start to work with a director really closely. Now, you work as an assistant floor manager. You work with the director in the office with the team, with the first assistant and his and the director's assistant. Usually then it was a lady, but in fact now men do the job, who type up all the scripts and are the liaison for the for the company on behalf of the department, to all the different factions that have to make your program, like cameras and sound and whatever, bringing all these people together with lots of paperwork telling what's going on and what's happening. So as an assistant director, I worked as assistant floor manager, I worked organising all the props and the assistant to the first assistant. So you were arranging all the actual production logistics, etc., for the director. When you become a first assistant director, it was called a production manager at the BBC, but it's a first assistant. That's when you start to really understand and having to understand the director's vision, what they want visually to see, how you have to arrange the equipment, the requirements for the director to achieve what he wants, cameras, sound, and letting know the heads of department exactly what is required technically on behalf of the director. You are the liaison. And then the director gets to eventually meet them and discuss in depth what they are trying to achieve, like tracking shots and crane shots, different kinds of lenses to get different feels of depth of focus, etc. So as a first, you begin to really understand what is required to achieve whatever the director wants. And of course, what you don't realise is that that's all, you are soaking it all up. If you want to be a director, if inside of you, you feel that's where you want to be, all this stuff suddenly becomes important. You begin to realise how important your job as a first is. And eventually, if you become a director, you then realise how important the first is to you. So, yes, later in life, I began to realise I've got to watch these people very carefully. The first time it hit me was I'd been an assistant floor manager for, I think, I came in 1969. So in 1972, I was attached to War and Peace. That was 2 years of making 26 episodes of War and Peace with John Davis. And boy, did I learn so much. I didn't understand at that stage how much I was learning, but it was all soaking into my body, as it were. And I began to, I suppose, flourish as an assistant floor manager to be of use, because I had learned so much about all the pitfalls of what can go wrong and also what can go beautifully right, etc. When I became a first, I really did understand, or start to understand, what is needed to become a director. So, yes, I also noted some of the great directors I worked with that I didn't probably realise at the straight away at the time. It was only after 2 or 3 months of working with them I realised how brilliant they were.
You mentioned War and Peace there, Graham. That, if memory serves, was the second in what I can refer to as the BBC's epic, serious adaptation procedures. The first one, of course, was John Galsworthy and I think the Forsyth saga, which was equally epic in scope and range. War and Peace, again, made in colour, raised the bar. Certainly BBC Two was the natural home for it, because it was, I think at that stage, the official line seemed to be that for people who are deep thinkers, or shall we say more educated or of a certain sort of viewpoint, BBC Two was the more intellectual station, whereas BBC One was the more popular based station. And ITV, of course, speak about talking about ITV because it was commercial. So there was almost a kind of classic hierarchical classist system in terms of what television stations you watched, if any of those three, BBC Two, BBC One and ITV. But I'm particularly interested in terms of War and Peace, because it was very much an epic production. Anthony Hopkins, of course, really sort of focusing in that. And I think certainly the battle sequences, which I believe you had a key part to play in terms of when these events are taking place over the hills and far away, they also kind of probably sort of set the sort of mind working in terms of obviously controlling large numbers of extras, large numbers of people, certainly hugely different from studio work.
It was enormous. I mean, it was a shock to my system and very exciting. I mean, to go away For 3 months in the summer and a couple of months in the winter in Yugoslavia. What was it called, Yugoslavia then?
Is now Croatia and Serbia, of course.
Absolutely. And we were in Serbia. Yeah, that was quite extraordinary. All the different things that happened there. There was a funny moment for me where I think it's what you were referring to, but I was sent at one point. They didn't have enough people for the special effects department who were going to set off big smoke bombs and whatever over to the other side of a big hill we were working at beneath, as it were. And the scene was that a whole troop of hussars were going to come chasing down a hill, all holding their sabres up in the air, charging, chasing off the French at the bottom of this hill. And so they had to start halfway up the hill when the shot starts. But we need to see on the other side of the hill, big smoke going off in the background where a whole battle was going on the other side. And they didn't have enough assistance in the special effects department. So John Davis said to me, would you mind, Graham, if you're not doing anything? We were so busy if I wasn't doing anything. But did I have spare moment? I could go and help the special effects department set off these smoke bombs, which meant they were set three or four places around the other side of the hill. And you had to go with matches and light them like fireworks, and they would last for about 7 minutes as you were blowing out smoke. So I said, yes, okay, off I go. So I took my boxes and matches and ran up this hill, disappeared the other side, and was yelled out by the first assistant. Right, when he said, stand by, Graham, that meant I had to light them off, light the things, and then report back. They're all lit, Gov. And then they queued the scene off when the smoke was big enough. And I've got the cue, lit these three or four areas of smoke bombs. And one of them exploded. I wasn't anywhere near it. I ran away by them. But one of them, instead of just billowing out smoke, it exploded and sent out a huge flame. And it was like 80 or 90 degrees in the shade. So all the grass was very dry there. And the whole hill on the other side set light. Well, of course, now he had not just a little bit of billowing smoke that they were going to get from the special effects. He got a huge amount of black smoke. It was for free. And I was trying to say, the whole hill's on fire, Gov, and nobody would hear me. The action was happening and it all went on. And eventually, I was running around the hill trying to put the flames out, as were three or four other people. The whole place was on fire. So the whole unit had to then abandon the shot and then come up the hill and actually beat the whole flame, all the flames out. It wasn't very funny at the time. It was funny later.
Health and safety would have probably had a field day if they looked back at that situation.
To say the least.
And was there not a situation where also, in terms of the radio control systems, that you were conflicting with a Hollywood production of Battle of the Bulge, etc., on the other side of the hill?
It was in another, I don't know where, which country they were in, but anyway, we were near the border of Romania, it was, and we were right near the border, like 2 miles away. And I was sent up a hill, another hill, but this time there were troops on the other side of the hill, and the shot was a low angle looking up the hill, and all these troops, again, load of hussars would come chasing down, but chasing French cavalry. So I had to cue off the French cavalry first. They went flying, and then cue the second lot to come over the hills chasing after them. So I got to the other side of the hill. I had like 20 cavalry for the French and about 20 or 30 cavalry for the Russians. I was waiting for the action, and the first assistant, called Ken Riddington, who went on later to do produce Tenko. But he was the first, and he said, right, when I say I'm going to go action, 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 Graham, and when I do three actions on the third one, send them over. And then count to 10 and send the next lot. So I was on the other side of the hill. Now, all this takes time, you know, and time is of the essence. So I'm on the other side of the hill on my own with all these troops or cavalry, which was Ken's voice, and then lots of horses going, whinnying and neighing, so that, you know, it was quite a lot of noise up there. And I heard action, action, action. So I sent them all off flying down the hill. And suddenly on the walkie-talkie, I got Ken saying, "What the hell's going on, Graham? Why have you sent them all over? I haven't said action yet." I said, "Yes, you did." "No, I didn't." So they had to send them all back up again. We did this the second time, and the same thing happened again. I got action, action, action. They sent them all off, and he went absolutely ballistic. And I'm a junior assistant floor manager, you know, so I'm in trouble.
Possibly not for much longer on this basis, I would have thought. Are you thinking, this is it, this could be the end of my directorial career?
This is the, well, not direct any career. So I sent them off. So eventually we got the shot. It all did go well, but he was not very happy with me. I was not in his best books or the directors. Anyway, that night, I had a counterpart, the equivalent of my job, who was Croatian or Serbian. And he was driving, he was an interpreter as well as helping me, or we did the same job together. And as we were driving back, he said, "Oh, it was funny this afternoon, Graham." I said, "Why? What happened?" He said, "When you were queuing off and it was all going wrong." I said, "Yeah, what was all that?" And he said, "What you didn't know, and the crew didn't know, was that there's a big war film, an American war film, being made the other side of the in Romania, and you were getting the first assistant from that unit shouting out to tanks to go over their hill or whatever." That was the reason why the problem was there. And eventually that got to be news to the crew, and I was forgiven.
Although there's surely a movie about the movie that needs to be made in which you could actually have tanks and cavalry both in the same image. I mean, that's just waiting to happen, surely. At the same time as all this is going on, of course, Hollywood is going through an interesting realistic phase, probably on the back of sort of French avant-garde cinema and so on. And there are movies like Midnight Cowboy, Emerging, The Graduate, other sort of zones. Do you still have chance now to actually go to the cinema? I mean, we talked obviously about how influential movies like West Side Story and Bridge on the River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia were. Or is this the moment of you're so locked into your work as a director in training at the BBC that actually seeing some of the bigger pictures, you don't have time?
No, I've always got time. You always make time to go and see all the films. And most of the time you're working, often on location when you're away somewhere, the big conversation pieces the next mornings are having gone to the cinema, you know, catching a couple of hours games at the cinema as a break from work. Not always. I mean, this might happen once or twice in a 6-week shoot or whatever, but you would all discuss, did you see such and such and blah, blah, blah. I went to the cinema and have a good discussion about sometimes it's technical, but mostly when I go to the cinema, even though I'm, you know, engrossed in something as a director of my own project, I'm able to let that go for the couple of hours I'm in the cinema, and I don't watch a film and go, "Oh, he did that," and dissect it. I just get enveloped into the story. I'm like a member of the public. I'm the audience. I don't dissect it. It's only afterwards I might discuss it at length with a colleague or my wife, you know, about the beauty of the music or how visual it was or whatever. It has to be really unusual for me to start discussing the visuals. I like to just let the film take me over and enjoy it like everybody. The movies that I watched at that period, they were iconic. The blockbusters have always been it. So like Apocalypse Now, French Connection, Clockwork Orange, The Connection. Do you remember that? The Conversation. Do you remember that? The Conversation.
Fantastic tape recorder.
Oh, it's extraordinary. I'm not going to talk about it. Watch it, everybody. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant piece of work. The Godfather, Five Easy Pieces. Jack Nicholson, wonderful, obscure little film, or maybe it wasn't, but it seemed to be obscure at the time. Fabulous, fabulous memory of a fabulous story.
And of course, Jack Nicholson. No, I was going to say Jack Nicholson actually also cut his production teeth as a co-writer on the sole movie made by the Monkees, a movie called Head. I don't know if you ever managed to see Head, starring Davy Jones, Peter Tork and company, but that was also co-written by Jack Nicholson.
No, I didn't know that. I didn't see it. So I'll look that up. That's interesting. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I don't know if that was a big success for Spielberg, but it was just fabulous movie. It was a very long film, I seem to remember, but I really loved it. And if it's on, I will always watch it. The mountain being made out of potato mash. That was quite extraordinary.
Absolutely. 1978. But moving ahead from the 70s, let's move on to another one of your musical choices. And we're just about to find out why you've actually decided to go jazz once again. I mean, after the first programme, of course, and the Dave Brubeck quartet, we're back with Errol Garner now. And they can't take that away from me from his album Concert by the Sea. Thank you.
Concert by the Sea. When I was, I think what I'm talking about here is that my love of jazz. I like all kinds of music, but I discovered jazz when I was 9 or 10 years old. As I said before, listening to a Crystal Radio, American Forces Network in Germany, hearing the greats. But my real appreciation and understanding of jazz, or not understanding, but beginning of my love for jazz, happened when in 1960, maybe when I was 15, I had a very close friend called Eugene Ankeny, who was half English, half American, who was also going to Italia Conti Stage School to be trained to be an actor. And we remained friends for several years after we left school. So this is just before we left. I was 15 and I was around at his home. His mother was out. He was brought up by a single parent, his mum. She went to jazz clubs a lot in London, and she obviously went to Ronnie Scott's. She loved it so much, and she was so often in there that every time she walked in, the house band, probably Ronnie Scott leading, would play Sunny Side of the Street. Every time she walked in, it became her signature tune. It was really nice.
Like Hello Dolly, perhaps.
It would. Exactly. So I was around his home one night, and excuse me, and he said, oh, you should listen to this. This is a really interesting piece that came out about 5 years ago. So in 1955, this album was released. It is sensational. If you don't like jazz for some reason, because you think it's too avant-garde or too third, I don't know.
Too American.
Or too American. This should change your mind. Because it's brilliant. It's a marvellous piece of music. It's by Earl Garner, the album. It's called Concert by the Sea. It has a whole series of tracks on it, obviously in a live situation, of his trio playing a lot of songs from the American, the Great American Songbook, I think they call it. So there are many tunes there that you will know, from Gershwin particularly, which the track we're talking about was written by Gershwin. What happens is he's a great improvisational pianist. So he will start something, you won't know what it is he's going to play. You don't get the intro that you would normally get to that piece of music. You'll get his take on it. So you'll have this strange rhythmic piece that starts the thing, the intro. Then you'll hear a bit of what you think, oh yeah, because you know the title of the thing. So it's obviously a song that you know well, is well known. And then he goes into it and gives you the real thing. And then I think they call it the middle eight, but the middle eight will be his complete improvisation of that theme. And it's exciting. Every piece is really, really exciting to listen to and interesting. And it's also interesting because he improvises a lot of it. So it's very exciting, and it never goes really off and makes you think, oh God, where's he going now? It's just very interesting to listen to. And the reason I like it so much, it gave me a real serious intro into jazz and what jazz can do to very well-known songs and how interesting it can be. And also, eventually, how this kind of music can be well used in films to back scenes and give lovely atmosphere to.
So why then, Earl Garner, Concert by the Sea in particular, Graham, does that actually sort of still sit with your good self in terms of possibly using it?
That track and then all the others, they can't take that away from me. When I listen to it now, I can see Anton Dubek from Strictly Come Dancing and any one of those fabulous female partners that he could have doing several routines like the American Smooth to any one of those tracks. In fact, if you took five tracks from the Earl Garner record, you would have a marvellous programme, so that everybody that loves Strictly Come Dancing would enjoy seeing Anton Dubek dancing to those fabulous tracks. It's timeless. That recording could have been done yesterday. It's absolutely brilliant.
You're listening to Sound and Director's Vision with Graham Harper, Graham Harper Sound and Director's Vision. And again, just we've managed to sort of work our way through a chunk of the 70s now. We've moved our way all the way up to 78, really, and touched ahead with respect to some of that. We've followed Graham's directorial trials and tribulations on hillsides in the former Yugoslavia. We've also covered a range of other factors as well. But we have actually reached now an unusual choice, another quite unusual, almost say left field, a musical choice. It's the Andy Shepherd Nocturnal group, basically, or quartet. Well, Graham, why have you gone for this little number?
So when you're making a programme, where music's concerned, normally you will finish your product, a film or an episode of a series or a one-off drama for television. You will then present that eventually to a composer who will create the music for you with discussion with you about what atmosphere, what you want to get out of it. And what happens normally is that a composer will watch the story and then you'll have a meeting and then go through it. So you go through scene by scene, playing the video of the piece and stopping and starting, saying, I want music from here to finishing somewhere there to 30 seconds later or a minute later or whatever. And he will tell you, or she will tell you, what they feel they'd like to give you, sort of, and you can use music, classical pieces of music, if you like, to describe the feeling you want. Could be jazz, could be rock and roll, whatever, but to give you a feeling, you could refer to an Elvis Presley song, for example, and say, I want that kind of feeling, it's that kind of rock number or whatever. And you go through it and discuss the atmosphere and the emotions you want to get out of the music. So that's the product leads what the composer is going to create for you. When I heard this album, which is a Nocturnal Traveller, I think it's called. When I listened to this, I've listened to this probably 200 times in my life, maybe more. I've listened to every track. You know, I've let the album run and listened to every track so many times. And each time I watch it, I can visualize something to go with that piece of music. And it's a complete journey to me, starting probably in Spain. It's a travel through Spain to me, through North Africa. So you're going across from Cadiz, if you like, over to Morocco, and then across, it seems to me, North Africa, and then coming across maybe to Italy, but certainly ending up in France and traveling through France, and you end up in Paris. That's what the music, I don't say that that's what the music was meant to do, but that's the journey I get from the music, probably because it's got quite a bit of background soundtracks from, it feels like films and whatever, or there's certainly some dialogue in different parts. So you get that flavour all the way through. So that kind of guides you. But you imagine a train journey. It's extraordinary. And I want to use that one day if the composer will let me. I would love, if I had the chance, to create a film around his music. This piece of music by Andy Shepherd is just stunning. And I beg you all, if you get a chance to listen to it, this album is called Nocturnal Traveller. It's a most wonderful experience. It's a piece of jazz, but it's extraordinary. And if you think you don't like jazz, I guarantee you, you'll love this.
¿qué tal?